At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum, from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at Bulwark. I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center, and Damon Linker of The Week. We are delighted this week to welcome a special guest, Bill Kristol, who is founder of The Bulwark and one of America's leading public intellectuals. So welcome one and all. Delighted to be with you again after a one-week hiatus. We appreciated hearing from all of those listeners who said they missed us. We missed you too. All right. To begin, let's start with getting through the winter. It is at this moment, the figure is 273,000 Americans have died of coronavirus. There were yesterday 2,798 alone on Wednesday of this week. So, you know, we've had lots of warnings. Now, in addition to that, the relief that was passed in March is running out. So, Bill Kristol, what do you make of the, basically, let's call it what it is, the climb down by Democrats willing to accept far less for a package than they had been talking about before? They had been using the figure of $2 trillion. Now they're talking about, I think it's $908 billion.
Yeah, you're so out of touch to be talking about millions.
Right? I'm sorry. Yes, I don't know what came over me.
It used to be real money. Yes. Was that Alfred Dirksen said that once?
Yes.
In the olden days. Yeah. Look, I think it's an interesting, I mean, leaving aside which party they both kind of were excessively stubborn and didn't feel much pressure, I guess, to really come to a deal before the election. And if they're feeling pressure now, that's good. I think whatever deal is made is frankly good because it can always be supplanted and supplemented by what happens after Joe Biden becomes president. And for me, it's a little bit of a test of whether we can, let me put it this way, we've been, all of us have been debating for a month at least, or almost a month since Biden won. Are we just in for 4 years of brutal trench warfare? Ron Brown seemed to describe the election results as making the trenches just wider and deeper than ever. And that would seem to be the safer bet based on recent history. Or conceivably, could you have sort of a moment where somehow there's enough disgust at the hyperpolarization and partisanship and gridlock and everything that you get at least in some areas, some people working together, maybe with leadership, that's the easiest way, but maybe with, non-leaders, gangs of eight and so forth in the House and the Senate. And we saw a little bit of that on the pandemic relief package. I haven't followed it closely enough in the last few hours. I'm not sure we know what's going to happen. But I took that as a hopeful sign that the Biden years might not just be a replay of the last decade or two.
Linda, there's a caucus in the House, a bipartisan caucus called the Problem Solvers Caucus. Now, think about that for a second. I mean, if they're the problem solvers, what are all the rest of them doing there?
That's right. We thought that was why we sent them, was to solve problems.
But they were instrumental in bringing forward this latest compromise
Yes, they were. Yeah, they were. And, you know, like Bill, I'm actually hopeful that we're going to see some movement. I mean, you've already had Mitch McConnell, you know, warming to this idea. They did get, you know, something that was very important to Republicans, which was a kind of limited liability protection for employers, which, frankly, I'm sympathetic to.
I was just going to ask you, I bet you are sympathetic to that. Can you just, right, so you're on the board of a very big company. Can you just explain to listeners why you think that's important?
Well, because a company can do absolutely everything right and still be sued. I mean, there are plaintiffs' lawyers out there in various states. California is probably the worst in the country, where you have very aggressive lawyers who will sue companies, and they generally go after companies that they think have the deepest pockets. And the company whose board I serve on is in the facility services area. It's a large janitorial company. And so you could see that, you know, we have done everything we can to protect our workers, and yet somebody gets sick or their family members get sick, and, you know, there's no way you can really prove how you got COVID. I guess maybe you could do some sophisticated DNA testing, but we don't see that usually done. So, you know, then they sue the employer because they think that we'll get a big settlement.
And right, they have big deep pockets.
Deep pockets, right, deep pockets. And so I do think it's important. On the other hand, I also understand that not all employers act correctly. I mean, mm-hmm. we've seen, particularly in the poultry processing industry, something where I used to be on the board of a big poultry processor. Thankfully, I'm not anymore because some of them are behaving very badly. They are, you know, there was a plant in South Dakota where managers were putting together a pool on how many COVID cases they were going to have. There have been people who've died in that plant. There was some indication that speaking to Spanish speaking employees, that the interpreters were not, in fact, giving the correct advice to those employees about protections. And they were being told that there were no active cases when, in fact, there were. So you don't want to protect bad employers.
Well, is McConnell, by digging in his heels on this liability protection, is he, you know, providing unconscionable protection to bad actor companies?
No, I think that if you can show evidence that an employer actively undermined and presented false information, you'd still have the right of employers to be able to press their case. It's a tough call. I don't want to see bad actors protected, but neither do I want to see the vast majority of employers who are not bad actors being ruined because of lawsuits. And even when you win a lawsuit, it can cost tens of millions of dollars to the company in, you know, legal fees, et cetera. So, I'd like to see some protection.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. Bill, you're, I think, always one for compromise, finding space in the middle. Do you think that the proposed bill is big enough? It would give $300 a week for the unemployed. By the way, their unemployment checks will run out at the end of the year. So this would provide $300 a week. The last bill in March provided $600. So what do you think?
I think the proposal that surfaced on Tuesday was the best that we're going to be able to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is it enough compared to what? Mm-hmm. And this bill is intended as a short-term emergency relief measure to build a bridge from the pre-vaccine world to a world in which the distribution of the vaccine is increasingly widespread. At present, there is no such bridge. Every single provision of the CARES Act will expire on December 31st, and many have already expired. People have exhausted their unemployment insurance, and many more will. The Paycheck Protection Program has kept hundreds of thousands of small businesses in business that otherwise, would have gone belly up and simply disappeared, leaving their employees in the lurch. Renters would have been evicted, will be evicted unless something is done. And more people are going to have a hard time paying their mortgages, et cetera. And all we need is a bridge to a world in which the vaccine enables us to get back to more or less normal life. I think the practical, economic, and social, as well as moral logic for acting in this way is overwhelming. And the only question is, what and how much. I should add that describing this as a democratic climb down is at best a piece of the truth. This is the product of a multi-year effort to create functioning bipartisanship in the House and Senate. The problem solvers were created in the first instance by a group I helped found, No Labels, about 10 years, which was founded about 10 years ago. And it has now become the largest and most influential bipartisan caucus in the House of Representatives. And many of the 9 senators who stepped forward alongside the problem solvers on Tuesday are members of an unnamed group that No Labels has taken the lead in creating over the past 6 to 9 months. So this didn't come out of nowhere. And it represents an effort not only to build from the center out, but also from the bottom up. This was done not only without leadership, but against leadership. And the fact that the Democratic leadership fell in line subsequently, and Mitch McConnell even made approving noises about this a couple of hours ago, calling it a move in the right direction, is a testimony to the fact that rank and file who want to actually solve problems are not necessarily as powerless as they thought they were if they get together. And I think this is a promising sign for that reason. Too much power has flowed to leadership in both the House and the Senate. It has exacerbated gridlock, and there may be a practical alternative to it that doesn't involve changing rules in controversial ways.
Well, that all sounds hopeful. The reason I described it, by the way, as a democratic climb down is that I was referring to the fact that throughout most of the last few months, the Democratic position, this might have been Nancy Pelosi, was that they wanted a $2 trillion package, and the Republican Senate position was that they wanted $550 billion. So arriving at a figure of $908 billion, if that's really the figure, does strike me that the Democrats gave more or sacrificed more, if you will. But anyway, let me move on to Damon. Damon, one of the things that we learned this week is that a big chunk of the money that was allocated in the Paycheck Protection Program that was meant for small businesses actually went to large businesses. This is always a problem with government. It doesn't have to do with the Trump administration alone or any given administration. It is kind of the way things tend to happen, don't you think? That, big guys know how to manipulate the system better than small guys.
Well, sure. I mean, it's a big, very complicated country. And when you're dealing with a program that's doling out a couple $1 trillion in aid, there's a lot of incentive to grab a piece. So in the end, it is probably inevitable that you're going to have some of that. We don't exactly know how much yet. Figuring that out would probably require a massive audit when this is all over. And I assume someone will undertake such a task. My own sense of it is that this was such a national emergency that I hope we don't get too bogged down in trying to kind of follow up on wrongdoing. I do think, obviously, if there was something truly criminal going on, we need to look into that and punish people. But by the same token, the money was enormous. And that actually, I think, is something that we have to keep in mind in talking about the current negotiations over a bridge package. You know, even in the darkest days of the Trump administration, this was the largest economic aid package I think we've ever seen, passed relatively quickly in just a few weeks. And it really has helped to do exactly what it was designed to do, which is, as Bill mentioned, to keep businesses afloat until this all ended. So we didn't end up with massive business bankruptcies, which then contributed to a kind of depression driven by an absolute command collapse in demand in the economy, that people simply could not afford to buy anything, which led to a downward spiral. So I think we've gotten through this well enough. We saw over the summer when the COVID numbers went down throughout a lot of the country that the economy really was struggling to come back remarkably fast. That gives us hope that when the vaccine is distributed widely, that the economy will bounce back again very strongly. A lot of money is sitting on the sidelines in people's savings accounts. And as people are going to be eager to spend, but not if people over the next intervening 2 or 3 months end up facing that kind of collapse that we were originally worried about that last spring. So I am, like everyone else, it seems, mildly hopeful that we're actually going to pass something in the next week or so, certainly before the end of the year, and that this is going to be a very good thing.
Bill, did you want to follow up?
Yeah. I just wanted to say, Mona, that although I certainly agree that the Paycheck Protection Program, regardless of its flaws, was positive for the country, positive for small businesses, and positive for workers, the regulations that, that implemented it could have been drawn up to prevent some of the excesses that we've been reading about in the past 24 hours. For example, why did a number of very prosperous law firms, including the one headed by President Trump's personal lawyer, get $10 million of forgivable loans from the Paycheck Protection Program? I do not believe that they were in any serious danger of going under the way so many restaurants and gyms and other small businesses have. And I just think that the program could have been implemented in a way to prevent these excesses, which I really think are quite smelly.
Good word. All right. Let's hope that we are seeing the birth of some benevolent bipartisanship. I wouldn't bet too much money on it, but at least so far, this is a good thing. All right, let us turn now to consideration of the cabinet picks by the president-elect. It's funny that we barely talked about Biden. You know, he won the election soundly, and yet, you know, he's not the front of mind because the crazy takes up so much of our attention. And we'll get to that in a minute. But let's talk now about the cabinet choices thus far. Bill Kristol. So some of these, some of these are just like a fantasy of what a middle of the road person would have wanted, right? I mean, Janet Yellen at Treasury. And what do you think?
Yeah, no, I'm pleased, and I think a lot of moderates are. Biden ran as a moderate throughout, and everyone kept waiting for him to. Not everyone, but a lot of people, certainly conservatives and Republicans, were expecting him, or claiming to expect that he would be caving to the left momentarily, and the forces were so strong, and that's where the momentum in the party was. And he never did really much during the campaign. Quite the contrary, I'd say. And now it turns out, guess what? He just doesn't want to, and he doesn't write for the country. He'll, of course, make some appointments to, you know, to each part of the party can feel good about. That's what any president does. But no, on the big appointments here in national security and economic policy, they've been quite centrist. They've been a lot of people who were in office, you know, before. And it's one interesting question for me, especially in foreign policy, is, you know, have they been a little bit mugged by reality? I mean, they came in with President Obama in 2009, understandably had really high hopes of how he could change everything after Bush and Iraq. I think there's a little more now of a kind of sober view of the world and of what can and can't be done and of the immediate task, which from my point of view will make them a little more centrist, I guess you'd say, in foreign policy. But I just on your first point for a second, it's so interesting. I mean, I've been on so many of this, several other podcasts and discussions, panel discussions. Yeah, everyone, it's like Biden's the last thing everyone talks about. First, we have to talk about Trump and the craziness. Then we talk about can the Republican Party be saved or can conservatism be saved or the future of conservatism, especially on a conservative-oriented, you know, outlet. And then if everyone gets around to, like, remembering that maybe we should say a word about the incoming president of the United States, it kind of matters how Biden does. I mean, A, it matters for the country, obviously. But B, it matters politically. I mean, if Biden is a reasonably successful president, our politics look very different, I think, by 2022 or 2023 than if he's some kind of failure, either because he failed because he was foolish or just failed because of bad luck, which could, of course, happen. The world is the world. But so I think Biden is a very important figure for the next moments of American politics, probably a transitional figure, but a transition to a better future or a transition to total collapse. I mean, it's really a lot depends on how he does.
This is so true. And Linda, you know, it's part of this, I do think, is a little bit that the press, you know, is having trouble sort of averting its gaze from the I won't use a bad word, but the show of Trump and turning toward Biden. I mean, look, the most news that he got this week wasn't for his cabinet appointments. It was for breaking a bone in his foot playing with his dog.
Right. No, you know, it's absolutely true, and I will use a bad word. They're having trouble averting their gaze from the crazy, because the crazy is entertaining.
Yep.
And, you know, if you are a cable news watcher, as I unfortunately keep it on in the background a lot of the day when I'm doing other things, and, you know, you've sort of become addicted to getting up in the morning, checking your iPhone to see what crazy thing has happened overnight. I mean, I had sort of hoped that as of the Saturday after the election, we could turn away from that and that we could go back to having a normal life. You know, it's been interesting. One of the things that I have found myself doing, and I probably disappoint you and others on the program, is turning to Fox News Channel because they cover more news. They have news beyond what's going on, you know, in politics. And as long as you stay away from the primetime programs, as long as you watch during the day, you watch Brett Baer at 6 o'clock. I mean, yeah, they're, you know, they're still not great, but at least I find out what's going on in other parts of the country, what's going on in the world.
Linda, that's what the BBC is for.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's what I'll do. I'll start watching the BBC. But, you know, I mean, I do think that Bill is right. I mean, I think that Biden is going to be a transitional figure, but, you know, pray God that it is a transition to normality, to going back to having, you know, a much more reasoned policy discussion on issues. I'm happy to fight with the Biden folks over policy. There are going to be lots of things they do that I'm going to be unhappy with. But I want to get away from attacking people, you know, all of this weaving of conspiracy theories. And, you know, I look at Neera Tanden, for example, who everybody is, not everybody, but at least Senator Cotton and others are saying, oh, no, she can't be nominated because of her tweets. What planet have they been living on?
Yes.
And maybe I don't think of her as a radical because I am not a regular consumer of Twitter, as you know. But she has always, I've participated in a program with her on occasion. And I think I'm not going to agree with her on everything, but, you know, she's not some crazy left-wing socialist. And in fact, some of the left-wing in the party don't seem to like her because they think she's too moderate.
Right. Well, Damon, they also think Ron Klain, we're talking about some of the people on the left wing of the party, they're not thrilled with Ron Klain. He's sort of seen as a centrist, and Anthony Blinken at State. They're not crazy about Avril. I don't know if you pronounce it Avril Haines as the new director of national intelligence, first woman to be in that post, by the way. Because she participated in the drone program in the Obama administration. So what do you make of those criticisms, and what do you think about the critique that, you know, he apparently is getting a lot of, you know, buttonholing over the fact that he hasn't named any African Americans to major positions yet?
Well, on the first point, I think it is, one of the issues that they're dealing with, even aside from ideology. Oh,
excuse me, except for Linda Thomas Greenfield, I apologize, as UN ambassador. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
I wasn't going to say much in response to that part of the question anyway, because I'm not big on I'll insult someone by describing it as bean counting, but I don't really think in those kinds of identity politics categories for hires. So I'll skip that part of the question anyway. I also haven't been keeping track. But on the other issue, as I was saying, apart from even ideology, you're dealing with the situation that Biden does want to go back to a kind of normal where, you know, politics is about doing things, policy, trying to come up with the best path forward for the country, you know, old-fashioned concepts like the common good, things like that. And, you know, you can disagree about what the common good is and how you reach it. But that desire to run politics that way out of a kind of public-spiritedness means that he's going to want to draw on people who have experience, who have done politics like that. And who does he have to draw on? Well, the people who were in positions of power under the last two presidencies, Obama and Bill Clinton, both of whom were pretty center-left people, despite some of the rhetoric against both of them emanating from the further precincts of the right, they were not all that far away from the center line. And the people who worked for them are pretty much the same. So the only way Biden will be able to kind of throw a few bones to the left will probably be by appointing people who have not had nearly as much experience in the upper reaches of the executive branch. So there's that dimension to, I think, the incoming administration's decision-making as well. They're sort of locked in to the normalcy of the way this usually works. And you saw it. I mean, when Reagan was in and the first Bush administration, that was 12 years of experienced conservatives. And so when you got finally to George W. Bush, wow, a lot of the people in the first Bush in the second Bush administration drew on people who had been in office previously. And that's the way it always works, unless you kind of break and say the whole system is corrupt. We need to bring in whole new people who have no experience. And I think you would have seen some of that in a Bernie Sanders administration, God forbid. You saw some of it in the Trump administration, and we'll see going forward. But I don't think we should be surprised that Biden is drawing on talent that actually has some experience under its belt.
What a concept. Bill Galston, I was a little surprised that when Biden named his Secretary of State, that he didn't also name his Defense Secretary. I thought that Michelle Flournoy was sort of had the skids had been greased for her, I thought, but he hasn't done that. Do you have any insight into what's going on at, you know, in terms of his consideration of the defense post?
Well, I've been monitoring, you know, the left wing critique of Michelle Flournoy, and which has been, a steady drumbeat.
Mm.
They don't like her. In part because they see her as more of a hawk than they want in that position. They especially don't like her because they see her as part of this endless revolving door process, you know, where you work in the defense industry, then you go to the Defense Department, then you go back to the defense industry, and so it spins. And like many other people in the defense biz, she has been around that door a couple of times. I think that the Biden folks were probably surprised by the breadth and vehemence of opposition to her. I don't think they anticipated that. They may end up nominating her anyway, but I don't think it's an accident that those two nominations weren't announced at the same time. Mm-hmm. But getting back to some of the other pressures on the Biden team, it's one thing to have left-wing criticism of the racial and ethnic composition of your appointees. It's another thing when Jim Clyburn starts speaking up,
yeah,
as he did a couple of days ago. And I can, you know, I think it would be very surprising if Biden did not nominate an African-American to head the Department of Justice. Indeed, I'd be astounded if he didn't in these circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If there had been more senior African-American appointments in the past week, maybe some of the pressure would have been off. But now it's on. And it will only intensify if the person who now seems to have been anointed the front runner at HHS, namely the moderate centrist governor of Rhode Island, Gina Raimondo, if she gets the nod at HHS, then I think it would be political malfeasance not to look at hard at someone like Deval Patrick, the two-term governor of Massachusetts, and someone with DOJ experience to head the Department of Justice.
Yeah.
By the way, can I jump in just to say that I see on Twitter as we record this that Raimondo will not be Biden's Health and Human Services nominee.
Ah.
So, because? Okay. Did she turn it down? Or
I have not read far enough to see the full story yet, but maybe the next time I speak, I'll fill you in.
Okay.
Because she's not a great favorite on the left either, because of the way she dealt with Rhode Island's pension system,
right,
which many public employees did not particularly like.
But I did. I thought, I think.
Oh, that'll save her number.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. Exactly. She's tops on this podcast, at least. And also my friend Mike Murphy loves her. He never misses an opportunity to plug her. But in any case, Bill Kristol, in light of what Bill Galston has talked about with these pressures on Biden, you know, there was a tradition before Trump that presidents would have one cabinet member of the other party. And I'm wondering, do you think that Biden will go with that tradition? And if so, who would you think he might select and for what?
Yeah, just to save Damon from later, from having to speak about it later. Yeah, it looks like Raimondo, she says she took herself out of the running. She's letting it be thought that she was a finalist. I don't think she's saying she was offered it. That would be inappropriate, presumably. And maybe she knew she was not going to get it and took herself out before not getting it. And maybe she thought she could get it and didn't want it, or thought there'd be too much. The Biden people asked her to take herself out because there was left-wing opposition to her. She's a pretty fiscally moderate, not to say conservative, person, and would be not a huge fan of like massive expansions, I imagine, of some of these programs. Anyway, so she seems to be out, and which maybe makes it better for Michelle Flournoy at defense. Jay Johnson, I think, would be a very good attorney general, actually. So I think you could see those two appointments pretty soon, maybe. The Republican, I've kind of assumed he would want to put a Republican in to one of those second tier appointments, and their issue, someone like Congressman Dent from Pennsylvania is a kind of pro-infrastructure, kind of old-fashioned, you know, Midwestern Republican of that type. Doesn't mind spending real money on roads.
Is he still in Congress, or did he retire?
No, he left in 2018, 16 or 18, I can't remember.
Right.
So he's, but well-respected, good relations on the Hill. Wouldn't hurt to have him there if they We're trying to peel off 10 moderate Republicans for some House vote at some point, which, you know, might be important. So I could imagine him, and there are obviously others and former governors and so forth. I would think that Biden would want to do that, and I don't really think there'd even be much opposition among Democrats if one of 15 or however many there are these days cabinet agencies goes to a Republican who supported Biden. I mean, it would be I don't think it'll be a Republican who supported Trump.
So one last note on the poll cabinet thing. John Kerry, former Secretary of State, was given sort of a position without portfolio as a climate advisor. Does anybody agree with me that when you take a post that doesn't have an inbox, you really aren't going to have very much power? Anybody want to comment on that?
Yeah, I disagree with you.
Okay.
He doesn't have a position without a portfolio. He has a portfolio without a position. Because I think that he will, in fact, be the point man on the climate agenda for the Biden administration. And that could be extremely powerful to have a point man, someone in the White House, you know, who will be talking with the president and the vice president on a daily basis.
Sorry to get picayune about this, but is he literally going to have an office in the White House? This is important.
Well, that would send an important signal, but I'd be surprised if he didn't.
Okay.
A guy I worked for a couple of years during his presidential campaign, Walter Mondale, who had about the driest sense of humor I've ever encountered, referred to the old executive office building as Baltimore.
That's exactly, you know, the West Wing is tiny. It is really, really small. Some of us have had offices there.
Yeah.
And the saying goes, propinquity is power. And there are very few places where you can park yourself in that tiny little suite of offices. But Bill Kristol, did you want to get in on this?
On the Kerry situation, I'm struck on this. I don't want to speak for anyone else, but I'd say, Mona, maybe people like us maybe don't appreciate how – I mean, I'm a moderate in climate, and I'm fine with doing things to slow down carbon emissions and so forth. And we published a million pieces in the Weekly Standard about conservative ways to do this with, you know, tax incentives and carbon tax and so forth rather than regulatory. And there's, I think stuff will happen on that. But I think people like me, I won't speak for you, but underestimate how important climate is to a wing of the Democratic Party. And I'm not saying this pejoratively or anything, just analytically, it really is. I mean, for me, it's important and we should deal with it. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's slowing the growth from 1.67 to 1.64. Maybe it's not the end of the world, but it is the end of the world for a lot of people. And as I say, without even taking a position on the merits of that view, it's certainly a strongly held view by an awful lot of younger people, people on the left, people even in the center left, though, of the Democratic Party. And in that respect, I think the Kerry appointment probably meant, I think Bill Galston's right, it sort of meant more to people and the cabinet status and a former Secretary of State. I think you and I looked at it maybe and thought, oh, that's kind of a nice, you know, kind of consolation prize for the former Secretary of State. And he loves going to conferences in Paris and he'll be certainly spending a lot of time at them. But does it really matter? But I think if he says this is not adequate, we're not doing enough, there would be a lot of people, you know, in the Senate and the House and at the grassroots who would say, whoa, that's a big problem for Biden. So I think he will turn out to be pretty powerful. I was on one of these panel discussions and there were, you know, a spectrum of people from around the party. And I was very struck by a young person from the moderate left wing, but kind of Sanders Warren wing of the Democratic Party, maybe not so moderate, said, we were chatting, talking about what would Biden do first. And I said, I guess I just have the obvious view that he's got to deal with COVID and he'll get the economy going. And I think if he could do those two in the first 6 months, he'd be in great shape. And he probably could avoid too many contentious fights, you know, and too many other things, which I thought was a pretty kind of obvious point. And this young man said, no, he's pledged to do climate first, and he's got to come out of the box with an extremely ambitious and broad climate agenda. And it just struck, and he's in, you know, I think he spoke for more people maybe than I would have realized. And in that respect, Kerry could turn out to be a little more important than might normally be the case with that kind of appointment.
Well, that's That's certainly possible, and I think that that way lies, it's fraught with problems. I mean, he risks alienating a big part of the country who are very, very sensitive about, say, you know, bans on fracking and that sort of thing. Linda, did you want to?
No, I was going to weigh in on the question of a Republican choice. And I mean, I do think that he will have to pick a Republican and it will matter whom he picks. It will be very interesting to see. He could obviously go with a never Trumper. I mean, Jeff Flake could be maybe persuaded to come in. I look at Larry Hogan. Of course, he just got reelected a couple of years ago, so he might not want to come in. And I think he has ambitions in 2024. But there are a number of others as well, and it will be interesting to see what kind of person he picks. Obviously, John Kasich would seem to me to be a very obvious choice, and giving him, you know, a HUD or one of the, you know, I don't think he'd go for transportation, but maybe he'd go for HUD. I don't know. I do think he has to do that. I think it's important to send a message that this isn't bipartisanship in name only, that there are going to be some real effort to bring people in to the new Democratic Party under Joe Biden.
Okay. And by the way, before everybody writes to me and says that I don't appreciate the importance of climate, I do. I understand it. I'm not saying that we shouldn't do anything. I'm just saying that if a huge package, such as the young man that Bill Kristol was mentioning, were the first thing that Biden did, that would be politically risky. Okay, let us turn now to the crazy, to the president's conduct. He's still not accepted the outcome of the election. And I just have to share with you all, if you haven't seen it, an article that was in today's Politico, which is really kind of funny. The headline is Trump's Georgia rally sparks GOP anxiety. So Trump is going down to Georgia Saturday. And one of the Republicans quoted said, if all he does is whine and complain and talk bad about Kemp and the Secretary of State, then the trip will be a disaster and he might as well not even come. This is a crazy time in Georgia politics, that's for sure. Well, that doesn't even begin to capture it. Damon, we've had Sidney Powell, the president's erstwhile attorney, she's no longer an official attorney for the president, going down to Georgia and saying, I would encourage all Georgians to make it known that you will not vote at all until your vote is secure. And similar messages from Lynn Wood. They're geniuses, right? They're suppressing their own vote.
I tweeted last night that this is like chess with so many dimensions that it's ripped open a black hole in the fabric of the universe. Like this is just total bizarre situation here, where you have the most rabid right-wing Republicans going so far that they're in effect telling Republican voters not to participate in the election anymore, basically to cede the Senate races to Democrats, I guess, to kind of prove a point. It's hard to fathom what anyone thinks is going on here, but this is just pure crazy town right now. You had yesterday the still sitting president of the United States dropping a 46-minute InfoWars-style rant about the election being stolen from him on Facebook that, as of this morning, the last time I checked, had 575,000 likes. This is so far off the deep end that it's hard to even wrap one's mind around it. And it creates a very bizarre situation for an analyst like me, because is this even politics? I mean, we've spent the first 45 minutes of this podcast talking about politics, right? Joe mm-hmm. Biden, the incoming administration, who is he appointing? What are his first policies going to be? How's the reaction to him among other factions of his party and in the other party? Will he appoint members of the other party to show bipartisanship? Will they pass a spending bill and so forth? Will they, you know, relief package? All of that. That's what we think of as normal politics. What Trump is doing...
It was a nice 45 minutes, wasn't it?
It was. Because now we're in the situation of you wonder, like, well, what is that? What is it that these people are doing? The drunk blonde woman who testified in Michigan yesterday about Dominion machines and tampering and votes. And then, you know, all the Lynn Wood nonsense down in Georgia and Trump's 46-minute video. That's not, is that even politics, or is it just some bizarre form of entertainment for some subsection of the American electorate who kind of enjoys watching a three-ring circus? I mean, I don't even know exactly how to describe it other than a kind of like weird version of right-wing kind of community organizing. You know, like Trump sets himself up on a milk carton and starts ranting and raving, and a crowd, a mob forms around him, and they all start screaming. And meanwhile, the incoming president is off actually trying to prepare to run the country, and all the serious people are doing that. But he's doing this other thing off on the side. And it's hard to know how to respond or to even predict, is this ever going to end? Right? I mean, yeah. Is it like when... After where is, I mean, I'll cede the floor in a second here, but one thing someone else could like reflect on, you know, is there really going to be a Trump rally opposite the inauguration on January 20th, where Donald Trump announces he's running for president in 4 years and anoints himself the heir apparent, the leader of the party who will be the, you know, the presumed nominee 4 years from now? Can he do that? Would it work? Will the media even talk about Biden's speech if that SHIT show is going on somewhere else? It's hard to fathom exactly what it means.
Linda, you wanted in on this?
I want in on this because, you know, Mona, we sort of laugh about it. We talk about it as crazy. I did that earlier, but it's really serious. And I think what we are watching in the Oval Office right now is the devolution of Donald Trump into a bona fide madman. And one of the things that I worry about is, you know, this idea that there'll be an alternative inaugural, I think, is the least of our problems. There's some sort of disturbing stuff going on at the Defense Department, where they have replaced, you know, not only the acting Secretary of Defense, but a number of people in top positions, rearranged various units to report to, you know, 30-something Trumpists in some of the offices. The Special Forces now is reporting to a 34-year-old or 32-year-old guy with absolutely no background to be doing this. And you have to wonder. I mean, you've got people around Trump, and I believe Trump himself, who believe that this election was stolen. I don't think that he's just doing this for show, or that he's just doing it because he wants to raise money for whatever he's going to do after. I think the guy is bona fide into a paranoid breakdown. And if that's happening, and if there are enough people, and they don't have to be that many around him, counseling him in this direction, are we going to see something even worse than a counter demonstration? Are we going to see him try to do something that really is sedition? And I don't put that out of the realm of possibility. I really don't. I mean, every time we think we've reached the nadir, we can't go any lower, he manages to do that. And I did watch that 46-minute tirade. I watched Lynn Wood down in Georgia and Sidney Powell. And these are really crazy people. And I think we're in a dangerous time. We used to talk a lot about invoking the 25th Amendment. I hope there are people within the Trump administration, some of the cabinet members and Pence himself, who are watching this carefully and who may in fact decide that they need to intervene here. This is scary.
But Bill, in order for the 25th Amendment to be invoked, you need a cabinet of serious people who take their responsibilities seriously. We're long past that. That's the scary truth.
We sure are. I think one of the big stories of November was how few of the horrible projections came to pass. When you look at the various disaster scenarios that were being seriously discussed, they were always possible, but it turned out that it was a remote possibility. I don't dismiss the possibility that someone who's totally unhinged could do things that were totally irresponsible or even seditious. You know, will Donald Trump begin as Andrew Jackson and end as Aaron Burr? I mean, who the heck knows? But it's not possible to rule that out.
But his lawyers argued before courts that if he did shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, literally, that he would be immune from prosecution for as long as he was president. His lawyers made that argument.
I'm aware of that, but I'm sure you remember the court's response as well as I do. That was not considered to be the strongest argument they could have offered, right? It was regarded more as a reductio ad absurdum of the position they were taking. And I am really struck by the fact that if this is a coup in the making, it's got to be the most inept coup in world history. The coup is mounted by the Peter Sellers of The Mouse That Roared or something like that.
A great movie that I recommend all of our listeners, especially our younger listeners who may not be aware of it, check out. Very wonderful classic. From when was it, 1950s?
Oh, no, I think it was a little later.
60s,
than that.
Maybe 60s. Yeah. Yeah.
But at any rate, I think we ought, as we think about these terrible things, we ought to try to attach probability estimates to them, as well as a simple assessment of how terrible they would be if they happened. I have to say that, given the overall structure of the Department of Defense, I think there are many braking mechanisms, some of which are in the line of command officially, but others of which are more institutional. I don't mean to sound complacent in the face of danger here, but having seen the falsification of so many dire fears, I'd like to try to keep my balance. And I think the country would be well advised to try to keep its balance in the face of this provocative behavior. We have to endure.
Hang in there for 7 more weeks or whatever it is. Yeah. Bill Kristol, our former party, though, the Republican Party, is really, for the most part, a wholly owned subsidiary of Trump and the cult. Maria Bartiromo, who used to be a serious journalist, gave Trump his first post-defeat interview, where she not only didn't counter him or contradict his ravings, but encouraged him and said, "This is terrible. We can't allow this to go on." And you have loony Joe DeGeneva, issuing threats against people like Christopher Krebs, saying he should be taken out at dawn and shot for saying that the election was not stolen. You have Governor Ducey and Secretary of State Raffensperger are now persona non grata, because they did their jobs. They told the truth. I'm inclined to agree with our colleague, Charlie Sykes, when he predicts that the Trump was robbed, stab in the back narrative will be the new orthodoxy for the Republican Party.
Yeah, I am too. I mean, obviously things don't go in a straight line, and so one has that big caveat, and things can zag. And it could be that January 20th is a big inflection point, I think, for if one wanted to be hopeful, one could say being an ex-president is awfully different from being even a lame duck president in the Oval Office. And a lot of the power starts to dissipate, a lot of the attractiveness, the appeal. A demagogue in Mar-a-Lago is different from a demagogue speaking from the White House and so forth. So I think there's some truth to that, and that would be kind of the hopeful side of things. But basically, you've got to say, for those of us who were involved in many, many discussions and debates and private and public on, you know, what about the future of the Republican Party, the conservative movement? I mean, the last month has been extremely discouraging for those who were hopeful, and it certainly seems to be so far confirmation of the bearish case that it's deferential to Trump, intimidated by Trump, and actually not repulsed by Trump. For me, that's the biggest thing.
Yeah.
Not
just
that there, people are sitting around in agony, feeling that I'm going to lose the election or lose something if I don't go along with this. So I'm just going to have a sleepless night, but go along with it. I don't have the impression they're having sleepless nights at all. They think it's all, you know, either kind of harmless or maybe a little funny or maybe half true, depending on how far gone they are. But in any case, there's the notion that we're doing serious damage to American democracy and government, either in the sort of short term, the way Linda was talking about, or certainly in the little bit longer term in terms of having a non-crazy, non-conspiratorial, non-demagogic, non- super divisive politics. I just think they're not concerned about it. And so that really, and if they're not, then it's always going to be easier to go that way. Someone will start out with the demagoguery and the next person will decide to try to one-up him. And a few people will sort of stay away from it, but will they really confront it? Why? You know, I think that I've underestimated consistently, how unworried they were able to make themselves, whether they were Republican elected officials or conservative elites, about things that to me, and I think to you, Mona, and a lot of us, were just appalling.
This is such an important point, Bill, because I've noticed when I read the justifications by people on the right about why they haven't spoken up about Trump or why they take a sort of bemused attitude toward him, they frequently say the same thing. They say, and Ron Johnson said this in a piece, well, he was quoted as saying this in the Bulwark this week by somebody who was repeating a private conversation with him, but a Republican official from Wisconsin. Namely, what do they say? They say, the institutions of our country are strong, right? And they assume that the institutions are so strong that there's any amount of arson and destruction that you can wreak on them. And, you know, I sort of had this image of them sitting in the burning rubble of what had once been the United States of America saying, you know, and on their tombstones, it will say our institutions are very strong. You know, they are weakening them. The institutions they don't stay strong all by themselves. People make them strong. People uphold them. And the only way to keep institutions strong is to continually reassert those virtues, those values. If you flout them, then you're undermining the strength of institutions. And that's the thing that I notice over and over and over again with the Trump justifiers, is that they say, oh, well, you know, there's no danger because somehow we'll all, you know, the strength of the institutions will endure. Bill Galston?
Yeah, I guess the only thing I'd add to that is political self-interest. This was a bad year for Donald Trump, but it was a great year for the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it exceeded expectations at every level below the presidential level, right? Total Democratic failure in the House of Representatives, near total Democratic failure in the Senate, the effort by Democrats to take back state legislatures so that they could have a bigger say in the reapportionment process was a total failure. They didn't flip a single legislature. I'd say the rest of the Republican Party might well reason, you know what? Our future should be Trumpism with a human face. Why should we change course? Why should we regard this as a danger to constitutional democracy when the democratic process is working out just fine for us? And we can go from strength to strength in the next 2 to 4 years. So the reason you're hearing this is in part because this was nothing like a repudiation of Trumpism as the dominant force in the Republican Party. Au contraire.
That, I'm afraid, is quite true. Okay, Linda.
Just quickly, I mean, I think Bill's right. But, you know, Mitch McConnell wants to be the majority leader of the United States Senate. And what the Trumpists are doing now in the state of Georgia is going to determine whether or not he will be the majority leader in the new Senate. And if that election goes bad, and I think it is altogether possible that it will, because so many people will be discouraged on the Republican side from actually even voting, I think you could see a change. I mean, Bill is absolutely right. And, you know, some of us actually weren't unhappy that the Republicans retained control. I'm feeling rather differently about it right now, seeing what's happened since the election. And I think if, in fact, you know, I'm actually no fan of Reverend Warnock, Ossoff, I know less about. But, you know, if the two of them get elected, that's going to be the end of majority leadership for Mitch McConnell. And he may look back wistfully at his opportunity to have stood up and been a man.
I'd only point out that Linda and I are agreeing in principle that the way to get elected officials' attention is for them to lose elections.
Correct.
And we're not arguing about the analysis.
Right.
Right. Okay, Linda, let's stay with you for our final segment, the highlight or low light that you want to emphasize.
Well, I wanted to point to something actually picking up on something that Bill just talked about, which is reapportionment. There was an important case before the U.S. Supreme Court that was argued this week. It was on whether or not persons in the country illegally could be part of the enumeration for the census. And of course, we saw efforts by the Trump administration to have a citizenship question. They hope to be able to exclude people who were not here legally and perhaps even exclude people who were here legally. It had a very skeptical audience this week, even from some of the conservative members of the court, including Amy Coney Barrett, who talked about the text itself. Oh my, what a refreshing thought that we might actually look at the text. And so, you know, I'm looking at that. It looks like they are not going to be able to produce the actual enumeration until after Trump leaves office. That was according at least to an article in Politico this week. But nonetheless, it's an issue that's going to matter. And if, in fact, you could exclude 11 million people, it would have an impact. And interestingly, it wouldn't all be the impact in places like California and Texas. It would also have an impact in states and in districts where Republicans have hoped to pick up seats. So this is going to be an interesting thing to watch.
Thanks. Bill Galston.
Well, I'd like to nominate some heroes. And by and large, they are Republicans at the state and local level who defied enormous pressure and did their duty as people responsible for managing the presidential election, the entire election, in fact, and for counting and certifying the results. The reason we're having this conversation and not a very different one is that the rot and corruption in Washington turned out not to extend to people in positions of responsibility at the state and local level, you know, who did their duty, upheld the rule of law, and preserved the integrity of the 2020 election. And they deserve our undying gratitude.
Amen. And also all the volunteers who man their stations at every election and give of their time to make sure that our elections run smoothly.
This could have been one of the most chaotic elections in American history. It turned out to be one of the smoothest.
Yes.
You know, despite the highest turnout in more than a century, 159 million people, it worked.
Yes.
Hooray.
Yes. Damon.
Well, I normally in this segment highlight something positive, something good I've read within the last week and recommend it to listeners. This time I'm more in the mood to highlight a villain of the week, and I'm going to make it Michael Flynn. Now, I'm not going to weigh in on the justice or injustice of him, his prosecution, FBI investigation, whether he was entrapped. I think there are powerful arguments and examples on both sides of that issue. But since he's been pardoned by our president, he has made very clear where he stands, and that is with the president, and even, if anything, to the president's right, in that this week he put his name to an advertisement calling on the president to invoke limited martial law to hold a revote. Basically, he wants to redo the election in the hopes that Trump will win this second time. And that I see as one of the most flagrant betrayals of American democracy by a major official, someone who's held important positions in the government and the military that I have ever seen in my life. So for that, I salute Michael Flynn. You are the villain of the week.
I completely agree. And I would just add that, for those keeping track at home, his lawyer who represented him during the last couple of years is Sidney Powell, none other than the same crazy Sidney Powell we've been seeing in the last few weeks. And there's one more thing to note about both of them. They are QAnon believers. Okay, Bill Kristol.
There's plenty to be worried about in America, but I guess I'll just mention two things quickly that are positive. One has been touched on already, the election, which was huge turnout in the middle of a pandemic. Not only went smoothly, but seems to have gone very accurately and didn't even have glitches that we had as recently as 8 or 12 years ago, actually, with people waiting in lines and a kind of de facto disenfranchisement of voters. Seems to have been very little of that. It's ironic, the one that Trump and everyone are making the most fuss about probably literally had the least error, fewest errors, and the least corruption or even distortion, you might say, of the popular will of any election in recent times. So, and that was done in this kind of crazy decentralized way we do things, a lot of things in this country, with a huge number of citizen participants and volunteers and people paid $25 to come for the day and so forth. And so that's a kind of heartening from a, let's say, Tocquevillian point of view about the state of things in America, and people turned out to vote despite some health risk and so forth, or had to figure out how to vote in a new way by mail and all that. The other thing, and this is more maybe of a Hamiltonian point rather than a Tocquevillian point, if you want to get fancy about it, is I'd say the courts, what everyone thinks, and the ultimate effect of all of Trump's appointees and the Supreme Court being more conservative and all, in this post-election period, there seems to have been, and I haven't followed every single decision and who's made them, but seems to have been responsible behavior by judges, and by judges, whether they were appointed by, George H.W. Bush or Bill Clinton or George W. Bush or Barack Obama or Donald Trump. So some heartening evidence of a kind of certain kinds of norms holding, at least in that part, not unimportant part of our government and in a way of our society, if you think of lawyers and the bar more broadly. So I think that's been sort of underappreciated in a sense.
Yes, there was I second that too. There was a particularly vigorous opinion issued in the Third Circuit by Stefanos Bibas, who's a former University of Pennsylvania law professor and was appointed by Donald Trump. But his opinion said, look, the voters choose the winner in our system, not the candidates. And it was a rousing bit of judicial writing and demonstration of what you're talking about, Bill. All right. Well, for mine, I would like to draw attention to a piece by our colleague at The Bulwark. Amanda Carpenter had a piece this week called "The GOP is a Propaganda Party." And I have to say, she came up with an image that is kind of unforgettable. And as a fellow writer, my hat is off to her, because when you can come up with an image like this, it's sort of the rest kind of writes itself. She found this there's a parasite that lives in the sea called Cymophthoa exigua.
Anyway, this parasite invades the mouth of a fish, eats its tongue, and sort of becomes the tongue of the fish. And then the fish sort of serves the parasite rather than the other way around. And this is the image that she used for the right-wing media ecosphere that has taken over the Republican Party. You know, she says, look, it's the people like Rush Limbaugh and Fox News and those folks, Hannity's and the rest, they are running the fish. They are driving the boat, as it were, not the other way around. People, she said, think that people at Fox News get their marching orders from the Republican Party. And she says, nope. It's the other way around. It's a very good piece. Again, it's called The GOP as a Propaganda Party. We thank you all for listening. I'll just put in one final plug for Bulwark Plus, which is membership organization that where you can join for a small fee and enjoy our live streams and our that the Bulwark does. We're doing one on December 3rd, which is well, this podcast will not air until the 4th, but we're doing one tonight with David Frum and Charlie Sykes and Tim Miller and me, and we do these on a fairly regular basis now, but they're only for Bulwark Plus members. So we urge you to sign up. If you go to the Bulwark website, you can do that, and we look forward to talking with you again next week. Thank you all.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms. At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms. At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.